Good afternoon and welcome to the National Press Club. My name's Clayton Boyce and I'm president of the National Press Club and news editor of Knight Ridder Tribune News Service. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you who are watching on C-SPAN or listening to this program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I'd like to remind our members of some upcoming speakers. On Tuesday, September 28th, General Colin Powell will give his last speech as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. On Wednesday, September 29th, Representative John Dingell, chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, will discuss health care reform. On Wednesday, October 6th, the Secretary General of NATO, Manfred Werner, will present a speech entitled A New NATO for a New Era. Other upcoming luncheon speakers include Labor Secretary Robert Reich, Chairman and CEO of Amgen, Gordon Binder, and author Stephen King. Audio and videotapes of Press Club luncheons are available through the National Press Club Library or by calling 800-952-TAPE. If you have any questions for our speaker, please write them on the cards provided at your table and pass them out to me. I'll ask as many as time permits. I'd now like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called, and please withhold your applause until all the names are read. From your right, Chris Hansen, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. David Lofsky, Reuters News Service. Les Blumenthal, McClatchy News Service. Mauro Espinosa of Notimex. Jeff Biggs, Press Secretary to Speaker Foley. Thought I got that right. David Hess, Knight Ridder Newspapers, and a past president of the National Press Club. Denise Keniston of KREM-TV, Spokane, Washington. Reginald Stewart, Assistant News Editor of Knight Ridder Newspapers and Chairman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee. Susan Moose, Administrative Assistant to Speaker Foley. Joan Lowy, the Scripps Howard News Service and member of the National Press Club Speakers Committee, who arranged today's luncheon. Richard Wolf of USA Today. Allison Boggs of the Spokesman Review, and Robert Nelson of the Seattle Times. I'd also like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Pat Thornsberry, and Melanie Abdo-Dermont for organizing today's luncheon. Now I'm here to introduce the Speaker of the House. And I was talking with Club Vice President Gil Klein just before the luncheon, and he remarked that introducing the Speaker of the House in Washington is like introducing the Pope in Rome. You say, here's the guy in the big hat again, and that about covers it. Well, one day this summer, House Speaker Tom Foley was having his usual morning chat with reporters gathered around his desk when someone asked him if he thought President Clinton was showing enough leadership. Everybody is exercising sufficient leadership, the speaker said gravely. It is the followership we are having trouble with. Well, Ted Turner said, lead, follow, or get out of the way, and that could be the motto of the House this year. The speaker and his lieutenants so far have managed to pass, sometimes by just one vote, every major program the new president has sent them. And some of their own, the budget resolution, the economic stimulus package, family and medical leave, the motor voter bill, deficit reduction, and the savings and loan bailout. In a climate of increasing partisanship, most of this has been done without Republican support. Many Republicans, though, applauded Tom Foley's election as Speaker in the summer of 1989. His predecessor, Jim Wright of Texas, had been called a high-handed, roughshod partisan. Foley was a listener, a personable negotiator, a fair man. But as the Republicans soon discovered, he is not a pushover. He is determined, and he likes things his own way. Last year's House bank scandal had the makings of a disaster for Democrats, and some did lose their jobs because of it. The Speaker was criticized by both sides of the aisle. But the reforms he announced and his unruffled leadership clearly limited the damage. His poise in such situations may derive from his early ambition to be a judge, as his father was. Tom Foley was born in Spokane, Washington, 7 months before the stock market crash of 1929. Both of his grandfathers had migrated west with the railroads to settle in the fertile valley between the Rockies and the Cascades. In the late 1950s, he spent 2 years as a prosecutor, two more as deputy state attorney general, and then traveled east to work for the late Senator Henry Scoop Jackson. In 1964, on the very last day to file, and at the age of 35, Foley entered the race against a veteran Republican congressman and won in the Johnson landslide. Working with both the Democratic leadership and younger party reformers during the 1970s, Speaker Foley climbed the ranks to chairman of the Agriculture Committee, party whip, majority leader, and finally to Speaker when Jim Wright resigned. An audiophile, he and his wife Heather, his unpaid chief of staff, live in Calorama with an array of stereo equipment that no doubt blots out the sound of congressional bickering. Burglars may want to consult me later for the address of that. In a further effort to keep House Republicans in line, Foley has learned Taekwondo and can now break boards with his bare hands. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the National Press Club the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Tom Foley.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Clayton, Reggie Stewart, John Lowy, distinguished guests at the head table, ladies and gentlemen. I'm delighted to be here again. I'm always pleased with the opportunity to address this distinguished audience. I like the introduction very much. It's true that I have, at a late age, taken up Taekwondo, and I've done a couple of showy things like break boards. We tried to do it on a nationally televised program recently, and the interviewer, a major figure in journalism, held the board out for me to break it, and I hit it. It didn't break it, but it knocked him off the podium, so they didn't use the film. He took it in good grace, and we're going to come back and do it again with different boards. There is a very important, I think, Congress underway, and I've been through many. I've succeeded in being reelected since 1965, and I am in my 15th term. But I think the 103rd Congress may well be the most remarkable and important Congress since the 89th Congress, and maybe exceeding the 89th in significance. Last night, the President gave a brilliant speech, I thought, in support of health care reform, made even more exceptional by the fact that the teleprompter was not working for the first 7 minutes. Some foul-up that Newt Gingrich made a little bit out of in the House floor today, suggesting that if you trust the bureaucracy to run health care, think about the fact they couldn't get the President's speech in the right order last night. The mention was made of Jim Wright. This happened to Jim Wright in 1984 when he was addressing the Democratic National Convention. Jim is a brilliant speaker, and he succeeded in carrying on without the teleprompter, which brought up for his perusal as he stood in front of an audience of 5,000 or 6,000 delegates and millions of people, the first line, growing up as a boy in West Virginia. It was Bob Byrd's speech. When Senator Byrd was later told about it, he was worried that Jim had actually given his speech, but that wasn't the case. These things happen. Anyway, the President, I think, laid forth the program for a reform in our health care system that may make this Congress remarkable as none has been, going back perhaps 60 years to the Social Security Act, in providing as much reform of our economic and social system as healthcare reform will provide. But it is an enormous problem. No one should underestimate the difficulty of translating the principles that the President spoke about last night, the clear problems in the system, into reform legislation. If we succeed, and I think it will be next year in late spring or early summer that we'll have a major vote on health care, if we succeed in beginning the process of major reform of the health care system, that will be one of the pillars that will identify this Congress as a reform Congress. And I would like to discuss some others today that I think mark the 103rd Congress as a reform Congress. We took some very difficult action in the budget. This was not a popular vote for members to cast, and indeed it passed by one vote in each body as a significant symbol of the fact that it wasn't popular. Increasing spending and cutting taxes is the more popular and easy political thing to do. This Congress was charged with reducing the deficit by reducing spending and by increasing revenues. And even though those revenues applied overwhelmingly to the very top level of our economic society, the top 1% of American taxpayers, it was a politically difficult undertaking. But we need to continue the process of reforming the deficit, of reducing the deficit, of engaging in even more spending cuts. And this will tie in the month of October with not only additional spending reduction proposals, but with the consideration, the beginning of the consideration of Vice President Gore's reinventing government, reforming the governmental system. Again, I think major institutions like the federal government need to have an opportunity given to them by the Congress and by the administration to review the basic commitments and undertakings that the government provides or attempts to provide to the American people. And we need the help of the country and the press, the media, in examining deficiencies in the federal government operations. Now, having said that, it's important not to overstate the problem. The problem is not that we have a government that's corrupt and totally broken and absolutely inefficient. Hundreds of thousands of federal workers go to work every day and perform valuable services for the country in providing for its defense and supporting its health and security and dealing with the myriad problems charged to the federal government. But we've all had the sense that the system has become too heavily overlaid with bureaucracy, that there is an insensitivity sometimes in responding to citizens' concerns. We have great expenses in the operation of government, which, although they are a minor part of the federal budget, can be an area for important cost savings, and that's one of the undertakings we will we'll make this year. We have a major crime bill coming forward, which in part will deal with reform of the political justice system, and will try to focus more resources effectively on the problem of crime. And we will be dealing in October with the difficult but important task of campaign and lobbying reform. I came to the Congress in 1964, 1965, with the election of Lyndon Johnson, as has been said, and I came as a reformer. I came as someone who thought that we needed to reform the system to make it more effective, more efficient, more responsive. And in our time, in the 60s and 70s, I think much was accomplished to do that. We took action to make government more open, requiring public meetings, public conferences, recorded votes in the committees and on the floor, giving the press and the public access where they had never had access before. We limited the use of various procedures by which powerful committee chairmen ruled the committees without an opportunity for individual members to offer amendments or move legislation. We did a great deal to open the process and to make it more responsive. In this last Congress, in the 102nd Congress, responding to some of the concerns and some of the publicity over things like the bank operations, we closed the bank, which had been in operation since 1837, when Lincoln was not president, when he was a member of Congress. We established a nonpartisan appointment process for the official that is in charge of all the administration of the House of Representatives. It is not legislative administration. The non-legislative director of services is a retired lieutenant general who has no political mandate, who was appointed jointly by the majority leader, by me, and by the Republican leader, Bob Michael. Unprecedented in any legislature I know. Unheard of that the majority party should give up the appointment of an official so powerful and far-reaching in his administrative capacities. We have abolished patronage as a method of staffing the House of Representatives. Individual members can still hire staff of their own choosing, but those people who operate the systems of the House of Representatives, from the post office to the paint shops, are hired on merit and merit alone. Very little attention has been given to this. I must say, in a moment of mild complaint, that much attention was given to the problems. Very little attention has been given to the solutions. And today, the House of Representatives, in my judgment, in administration terms, is the most nonpartisan, business-managed legislature in the country and parliament in the world. Now, there are still suggestions that we need political and structural reform in the Congress. And we're going to take up a very important campaign reform effort in the month of October in the House. The Senate has already passed a bill, frankly criticized in many quarters as inadequate and insufficient. But we ought to judge campaign reform against what goals we have for it. We want to make the system more open in the sense of giving candidates an opportunity to seek office and to have an opportunity to lay their case and cause before the people and have an opportunity for election that isn't totally dominated by either the power of incumbency or the power of money. And that needs to be the guide by which we judge part of the reform process. Some of our abilities to reform are hindered by constitutional limitations. For example, I think one of the principal reforms should be to limit the amount of campaign spending. Obviously, different standards have to be adopted for the House and the Senate because of the size of state constituencies. But there is too much money in politics. Members of Congress, and those who are challengers, have to spend too much time raising money in order to have an opportunity to put forward candidacy. If we, however, limit campaign spending, the question is, what about a person of great wealth who can spend $5 or $6 million of his own money, as happens now more often than we understand in both House and Senate races? And there is nothing against the capacity or ability or service of rich people. They've contributed a lot to the country and to the Congress, and there are splendid senators and House members who are extraordinarily well off. But that should not be a requirement. It should not be a fundamental requirement for service in the Congress. And politics and political reform need to try to deal with this problem. I believe the best way to do that would be a system that included a major element of public financing in the election of members of Congress, as we do in the case of presidential candidates. I believe in that. I supported it many years ago when it was first introduced in the House by Morris Udall, H.R. 1. And I believe that it is difficult to achieve the same level of reform without a major element of public financing. Having said that, I think you who cover Washington and know the politics of the city and the country understand that it is not easy to get citizens to support the concept of public financing of congressional elections. There is an easy kind of cheap shot on the other side that says, Congressman so-and-so, after spending all this money on a lot of questionable projects, now has the audacity to come forward and suggest that you, the hard-pressed taxpayer, should pay for his campaign. The reality is, incumbents believe that public financing is a basic benefit to challengers. It is, on the average, an advantage to challengers. And when they support it, poor fellows, they think that there should be some public applause for their putting reform above personal advantage. That isn't what happens very often in the reaction to public financing, and it has been extraordinarily difficult to get support for it in the actual context of campaign reform. The Senate rejected it, and we will have a very hard time getting the votes for public financing in the House. Having said that, we're going to continue to do what we can to make that an element of campaign reform. Limitation of political action committees as well as overall spending, will be part of our campaign reform effort. Now, I stop at the point when people suggest that political action committees are bad, are inherently bad. They were, after all, a reform that came into existence at the end of the Watergate period to insist on accountability of those groups and organizations that were making political campaign contributions from individuals or members of their organization. There is nothing wrong with political action committees, in my view. There may be something wrong with members depending too much upon them, having too large a portion of their campaign finance come from them. So we will attempt to find an appropriate level of limitation for PACs, for political action committees, a third, a 45%, or something in that area, and restricting use above that. We'll also probably limit to a degree the amount of larger contributions that members of the House can receive and encourage them to receive contributions under $200. Beyond that, we'll have to deal with the soft money questions, the questions of so-called bundling of campaign contributions. And I believe when we finish the process, we will move forward on those goals of having the process more open, of having the level of the field better adjusted to equal opportunity between challengers and incumbents, and enhancing the ability of the public to make decisions. On the other hand, I think we sometimes have proposals for reform that are what I might call false reform. That's a suggestion that was made in a brilliant paper recently published by Tom Mann and Norman Ornstein, who suggested that what we ought to do with reform is look at the function of the Congress, which is deliberation, decision, and ensure that what we do under the guise of reform does not create a situation where what might be called the bad habits of the Congress are reinforced, playing to the crowd, so to speak, to home constituencies without regard to more the merits of the proposal, of moving toward playing to the media, of looking for short-term solutions. All of those things need to be judged in the course of judging campaign and other reform elements. Lobbying reform is another area that we're going to take up. Lobbyists are sometimes, again, widely bemoaned as having too much influence in Washington. I see nothing wrong with a greater disclosure of who represents whom and what they receive in terms of their representation and what they expend in the course of that representation. And I think that disclosure and that advanced requirement of information and reporting is good. On the other hand, lobbying is not bad. It's protected by the Constitution. And the Congress needs all the information it can receive. My experience in Washington is that it's a bad lobbyist who comes to you, obviously they all have a point of view, who comes to you with distorted and misleading information, because that can happen once. You're maybe persuaded wrongly once. You're never going to trust that individual lobbyist again. So by and large, they try to persuade, but they also try to provide information that's useful. And our problem with lobbying may be that the public confidence in the system has been eroded by the suggestion that lobbyists are more important than the public and the public's opinion. That's not, in my judgment, true. The members of Congress are still extraordinarily directed to representing their constituency. It's a very responsive system. But we can perhaps encourage public confidence by including in the reform package this year greater reporting for both the expenditures of lobbyists and the information on who their clients are. Beyond that, the Hamilton Committee, known in the House as the Hamilton Committee and the Boren Committee, named after the co-chairman, Lee Hamilton and David Boren, will be making a more fundamental report on restructuring the Congress at the end of the year, and it'll probably come up in the early days of the next session. I don't know what that will be in total, but it will include, I know, recommendations for structural reform. One of them that I'm strongly in favor of, because I think it is a matter, again, of public confidence, is to make it clear that all the laws we pass, which have the effect of empowering individuals and minimum wage, on protection of their civil rights, of protection of the rights of disabled and so on, apply fully to the Congress as we apply them to the rest of the country. We're going to have a separate method of enforcement, but it's going to be clear that there's no diminution of enforcement of these regulatory laws on the Congress as well as by the Congress. And we will establish a mechanism to ensure that that is clear, including a provision of judicial review. We have always the task from time to time of facing a public opinion that is critical of the institution, far more critical of the institution than it is of individuals. Most members of Congress are held in, believe it or not, still in relatively high esteem by their constituency. After all, they have to be elected. And most of the polls report something like 55 to 60% support for incumbents by their own constituency. It is the rest of the Congress, the sort of vague, unknown, impersonal Congress that is not often trusted by the country. And this gives rise to such things as discharge petition processes and term limits and so on. On term limits, I flew into my own congressional district about 2 weeks ago for a visit home, and the pilot of the United Airlines plane on which I was flying wrote me a nice note on his card. He said, very glad to have you on board, Mr. Speaker. I hope you're enjoying the flight. I hope also you will support H.R. 1234, whatever it was, by Congressman Lightfoot of Iowa to allow pilots to fly after their 60th birthday. And I wrote him back on my card a note, thank you very much, Captain. I'm enjoying the flight enormously. Be assured I am against term limits on the ground or in the air. But my message today is that we're serious about reform. This Congress, in so many different ways, from the budget to health care to campaign reform to lobbying reform to institutional change, can, I think, have the designation and the distinction of being a reform Congress. It's one of the things that I hope will be achieved in the coming months, and one of the things I hope we can all be proud of at the end of the next session of Congress. It's been a great pleasure for me to be here. Thank you very, very much for your hospitality.
Speaking of term limits, why are you so adamant in your opposition to congressional term limits? After 12 years in office, do you really know how hard it is to defeat an incumbent at the polls?
Well, I've been in office longer than 12 years, but that's the implication. I've been in office 28 years, but I am frankly one of the few members that have served that long, just incidentally. There's somewhat of a misconception about this. I'd have to look at the statistics, but I think probably two-thirds of the Congress today does not remember Ronald Reagan. Has been reelected. They remember him. They know him as an historic figure, but I mean they didn't serve with him. They've been elected since he was president. And when we had a whip meeting, which has about 80 Democrats in it, after President Clinton was elected, but before he was inaugurated, one of the members said, well, is everything going to be easy now? Is everything going to be wonderful now that we have a Democratic president again? And I said, well, not necessarily. There'll be problems. There'll be different problems. There'll be welcome problems. But you all remember we had a few problems with President Carter when he came to office. Blank looks. I said, you know, you all remember the first months of President Carter's administration. Still blank looks. I said, how many of you 80 remember President Carter? I think 6 or 7 put up their hands. Again, they remember him as an historic figure, not one that they had actual experience of joint service with. So the Congress does turn over dramatically. And that refreshing, if you wish, of the Congress is a reality without term limits. Why am I against term limits? If it is for the purpose of making the campaign easier for challengers, then I think we ought to deal with campaign reform rather than term limits. Basically, term limits are wrong in my judgment because they're not limitations on politicians, they're limitations on voters. And they're basically not motivated by a desire to change the member that the individual voter votes for, that member of Congress or that challenger. They're designed to try to get to the other person's decision in the next district. by turning around that person and forcing that person out of office. There are a lot of other reasons. I think it would unduly enhance the power and influence of staff and bureaucracy if you force people in and out. I think it would limit the number of people that would want to seek office, not necessarily that they want to stay forever, but if you begin by the requirement that they have to leave in 6 years, many of them probably would not want to undertake that until perhaps the end of their business or professional careers or later in their lives. I think it'll have impacts that are not really wanted or particularly sought, but are sort of consequences of it. Anyway, what I'm doing right now, which has caused some criticism, is engaging in a lawsuit to try to decide whether the Washington state statute and similar statutes that impose term limits on members of Congress or attempt to are constitutional. I don't think they are. I think you can have term limits by a U.S. constitutional amendment. And I think we need to know, proponents and opponents, whether states by referendum or legislative action can impose term limits or whether it takes a constitutional amendment. The Republican National Convention for the last three times, I think, has taken a position in favor of a U.S. constitutional amendment. I think they're right on the procedure, wrong on the purpose, but right on the procedure. So I hope the courts will have an early opportunity to decide that issue.
Will the House pass a toothless campaign reform bill with no provisions for public financing or TV postage subsidies? How can you hope to enforce spending limits without such incentives?
I don't know whether this is David Hess or not. Is this you, David? Mm-hmm. We spoke a little bit earlier in the day about this. I think campaign finance reform would be, as I said earlier, enormously enhanced by public financing. It's not for lack of my advocacy or others that it will be in or out of the bill, but I do think that there is this public perception, which is very hard to get through to individual voters, that is somehow a subsidy to incumbents when exactly the opposite is seen by incumbents to be the reality. We'll try to do our best. We'll see what else can be done to deal with some of the problems that we've identified in campaign reform. One of them is just to lower the level, I think, of spending within reason. And it's a delicate balance, because if you go too far, you know, I admire Bill Proxmire, but every time he's on an interview, the reporters always say, oh, it's wonderful that he ran a campaign for $7,000 or $6,000 or $5,000 or $2,000 or whatever it is. If you want to really enhance incumbents, put the limit down so low that no challenger will have an opportunity to put on any kind of a campaign. That's wrong. It's also wrong at the other end that members of the House have to raise hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars in some cases, to be elected to Congress, and those who consider a Senate run have to think in terms of, in many cases, $10, $15 million to make a realistic run in a large state. So somewhere between those extremes, we hope to hit a balance and to deal with questions of soft money, bundling, other issues. But to set a standard that says if without public finance, it's not real, without public finance, it can't have any improvement and reform of the system, I think is wrong, much as I favor public finance.
With reference to your next reelection campaign, will you limit your overall campaign spending? Will you limit your contributions from PACs? Will you limit your contributions from citizens outside your district?
Well, I'll do whatever my opponent was willing to do. I'm obviously one of have an even balance on that, with one exception. I'm not going to limit my campaign spending to what I myself can spend, because I just finished a campaign with a very rich candidate who financed very large amounts of his campaign from his own resources. But I think it's possible to engage in an undertaking with an opponent where you both agree to spend a limited amount of money or otherwise set some ground rules. But it has to be two-sided. I mean, I wouldn't do it just on one side without my opponent also agreeing to it. And I think that doesn't solve the problem of campaign finance reform, because it's not easy to get those kinds of agreements. The other thing is that each one of these proposals ought to be looked at very carefully to decide whether it actually is reform. Let me give you an example. It's widely believed that it's a reform, as this question suggests, to limit contributions to within inside the state or inside the district. That, again, often is a great benefit to incumbents and a limitation to challengers. Women and minorities who have come into this Congress in greater numbers than any other Congress in our history, to its benefit and to the benefit of representative democracy, could in many cases not have been elected without the contributions that come from concerned citizens outside that immediate district or state. And the efforts of groups like Emily's List and other groups to provide resources for candidates who are women or candidates of minority status is very important in advancing the breadth and representation capacity of the Congress. Now, if you want to eliminate that, you say raise all the money in the district. Also, some districts have just an historically different pattern of giving than others. There are major cities in the country where political campaign giving on both sides of the aisle is understood and supported. I remember representing a rural district one time when I got a contribution of $500 from a very well-off farmer in a small wheat town. And I was so pleased, and I thanked him so heartily and shook his hand several times, and went back to Spokane, my home city, and ran into my campaign treasurer, who was the vice president of a national bank. And I said, Dave, I got a $500 contribution from Tom Kelly, the big farmer down in Lincoln County. And my campaign treasurer and vice president of the First National Bank looked at it. He said, this is a check for $5. I said, no, it's a check for $500. You know, it's Tom Kelly. He owns all the land, owns a township of land out there. And Dave said, look, I'm a banker. You can't get more than $5 for this check anywhere. And now Tom Kelly didn't mean anything by that. He wanted to help. But he was not particularly in the culture of realizing that $5 is nice, and I didn't throw it away. But I didn't cash it either. I kept it as a souvenir. There's a different style, and we have to look at the hard realities of politics. Let me just say one other thing about PACs, for example. PACs are the easiest of all contributions to trace. You don't have anybody who's in this business knows. You can find out right away who a PAC is, where it comes from, what their board of directors consist of, what their principles as stated are, and so on, who they represent. Individual contributions are sometimes more difficult. And when one is inside the political system, I would be more concerned sometimes about a contribution from an individual who I didn't know, whose concerns and interests I wasn't aware of, and whose reason for making a contribution I wasn't sure about, than I would about a political action committee. And I don't understand the suggestion that political action committees are somehow hedging and influential with decisions of members of Congress. Well, it's never a problem to have an individual contribution of even a larger size than presently permitted by law.
On lobbying reform, how do you intend to resolve the gift issue? A stricter disclosure rule, or a gift ban, or travel ban?
I think my own tendency right now is to think that the gift rules, which we adopted a couple of years ago when we barred honoraria, have worked fairly well, and that perhaps the best way to approach this is with greater disclosure, to have lobbyists make greater disclosure of any expenditures they make in connection with contacts with members of Congress. Again, the caveat is you have to be sure that this works as intended. One of my colleagues who was in the state legislature said that they had a little problem with this when they worked on it in the state level, because very often people who were lobbyists, for example, would have a luncheon or a dinner or something like that, and they would invite members of the legislature. And they would include in their reporting all the members who were invited without checking on who actually attended. And so the members found themselves listed as having been entertained by a lobbyist at a dinner that they never attended. So those are technical matters that have to be dealt with. But I frankly think that the current effort to get the gift rule down to the level of something like $20, as the White House does, and to include meals, may be a little rigorous. I mean, it is, in my sense, sort of nonsense that the White House felt they couldn't accept invitations to the National Press Club to support a foundation for journalists because the dinner might be more expensive than $20, as if they were somehow, being cozened by a dinner for that purpose. So I think, you know, again, a rule of reason here. I haven't yet seen a meal, certainly not a meal here or any place. No, that's not. I enjoyed the dinner, lunch very much. Or in any restaurant in Washington that I felt was inhibiting or created some kind of problem in terms of being a guest. So I think we need, again, a rule of reason. And there's a little hint of it being demeaning if you get to the point where a member of Congress has to decide that an editorial breakfast by a press agency or press firm or newspaper or a network, whether he or she can accept the breakfast of fruit and granola because it's served by a waiter and might exceed 1999. That's getting a little bit crazy, I think. So, but I'm more inclined to go and answer to the question on the disclosure than on sharply reducing the gift limit. On the other hand, there isn't any particular reason, as far as I'm concerned, why we should be concerned on other things. I'd be glad to have the gift limits go down to $20. I'm a little worried about the meal thing because of ordinary hospitality and ordinary meeting conditions that would make it difficult sometimes and awkward.
I would like to correct that was the Washington Press Club Foundation dinner, not the National Press Club Foundation right. dinner. But our own benefit dinner, the Fourth Estate dinner, is coming up in November. And I'd like every member of Congress to attend, so if you could take care of that for me, I'd appreciate it. Reforms. Among solutions, would you support legislation making the House subject to existing civil rights laws, as you had talked about laws applying to Congress that they are now exempt from? This was to protect women and minorities from harassment and discrimination.
Absolutely. They currently apply to the Congress, and the question is how we enforce them. Because of the separation of powers, we have typically insisted on having a separate agency of enforcement within the legislative branch rather than being subject to executive branch agencies. But I think the steps will be taken shortly to ensure that that is a totally impartial tribunal, that it is not subject to any influence by members of Congress, and that there will be an appropriate opportunity, as there is in the private sector, in the non-government sector, for judicial review. And I expect that to happen in this Congress. I would expect it to be part of the Hamilton-Boren recommendations, but be acted on in any of them.
Ralph Nader and others are calling for cuts in congressional pay. And polls have, some polls have shown that up to 80% of Americans support a congressional pay cut. Will you comment on the efforts to cut pay for Congress?
I think it's a wholly bad idea. I have no sympathy at all for it. That's not meant as a joke. It's just true. I think I don't want to try to interpret Ralph Nader's motives, but I think he's uncomfortable with anything but a fairly lowly paid Congress. I mean, one in which there is some difficulty in meeting the cost of living in your district and in Washington. Some years ago, there was a statement made by Ralph Nader in my own district in which he said that the current pay ought to be enough for me. With all my perks, and as he put it, all the money I can steal. I was so angry that I was at the point of consulting my solicitors, as they say, and it was promptly pointed out to me by what I already knew, that Sullivan versus New York Times was not going to make it easy to respond to that outrage. But I did complain to another member of Congress who had worked for Ralph, and he went to Mark Green, who was then Ralph Nader's assistant, and said, "What about this?" And he said, came back to me and said, "You wouldn't believe this." I said, "Try me." He says, "Mark says you shouldn't feel personally offended. He says that about every member of Congress that voted for the pay raise. It's boilerplate, Republican or Democrat, whatever the circumstance, he uses that language. It's an example of how political rhetoric has deteriorated in the country. But in any event, let me talk to the issue. There is a possibility of creating a Congress which would be a little bit like a 19th century House of Commons, where people of economic privilege and advantage would have an opportunity to serve, and almost anybody else would have to be very careful about doing that. I don't think we ought to encourage that. Again, I don't have any problem with the fact that there are rich people in the House and the Senate. But I hardly think it's a good idea to create circumstances where that is possible. Obviously, it's always popular to cut, you know, congressional salaries or government salaries. If you take a poll, there's probably no limit to the degree that people will support it, 10%, 20%, 50%. If you got it down to 100%, you'd probably find a significant number of people who would say, 100%, take it away at all. And by the way, why are they willing to serve if they're not paid? Would be the next question. So it's probably always going to be with us. There is some irony in the fact that until recently, I was better paid when I was a freshman member of Congress in 1965, in real terms, than I was any time up to about 3 years ago. And there's been some slight change since I became Speaker. But also, very frankly, I'm the third constitutional officer in the country, and the Vice President and the Chief Justice and the Speaker are paid the same. It's a very, very small fraction of what minor vice presidents in American corporations are paid, and a tinier fraction of what the average NBA players pay. In the rank of people from my home city, I'm way, way down on the list. And I don't know whether Mark Rypkin is at the top. He's a Spokane man. But certainly I think that public salaries in the United States are no longer at a level that can be said to be high compared to private compensation or comparable responsibilities. The answer is no. In case you didn't get that.
Despite the opposition of Richard Gephardt and David Bonnier, will the House of Representatives approve NAFTA?
Well, I believe they will, and I hope they will, because I think NAFTA is the right choice. But I also think that we need to respect the views of our colleagues in the Congress. For example, there's no one whose ability and character and judgment I respect more than Dick Gephardt. I've served with him. I supported him very vigorously when he sought the presidential nomination. I think he's wrong on this one, but I salute him for taking the time and the effort and the care in reaching his decision. He didn't start out with a kind of a knee-jerk reaction of being against NAFTA. Well, he even says today that he would be for it under circumstances which were different, that he believes we ought to expand our trade, that he doesn't believe that this is the best agreement that can be written. And again, I don't agree with him, but I respect his judgment. We have to have that kind of respectful and conscientious debate on this. There is a problem, and I just frankly confess it to you, that the proponents of NAFTA are much more seminar-like in their support for it. The tendency of support statements is to say something like, in the broad course of trade relations since the end of World War II, a general expansion of trade has been a enhancement of individual income and national growth and contributes to the possibility of economic advances, you know, whatever. Whereas the no's come up and say, if you vote for NAFTA. So there's an intensity factor that needs to be addressed a little bit in the debate that's going on right now. Let me say another thing that I think we need to consider with NAFTA. Not only the positive aspects of what I think the agreement would provide, but what would happen if we reject it? We will not go back to just the present status quo if NAFTA is rejected after being formally considered and voted on. I think you will send a message, a very unpleasant message in their terms, to Mexico. I think there will be a reaction to the rejection that may have consequences for many years. And I think that message will go beyond Mexico to Central and South America. Someone once said that two things unite us in Spanish America, our beautiful language, and some distrust of the United States of America. I think that there is a danger that distrust could grow if there is a thought that we do not wish to broaden our trade under appropriate circumstances with this hemisphere and the southern hemisphere in due course. It would create the largest trading organization in the world, the largest trading bloc in the world, and I don't perhaps use the word block correctly, the largest trading area in the world. And I think it would be enormously enhancing of not only jobs in this country, but economic activity in Mexico. One of the things my former boss and mentor, Henry Jackson, used to worry a lot about was a Mexico that fell farther and farther behind in economic and social and political development compared to the United States. And I think we all have to salute President Salinas and the marvelous changes that occurred in Mexico, the movement economically and socially in that country. And I think NAFTA would enhance that, not to our disadvantage, to our advantage, and that's the reason I'm going to support it. But it's going to be a close vote. It's going to depend on very heavy contribution from the Republican side of the aisle. I think at the moment, probably a majority of Democrats do not favor it. A majority of Republicans do. And it's out of that combination of Democratic and Republican support that a majority needs to be formed.
What compromises could help save the NAFTA accord? Would the inclusion of Caribbean nations in NAFTA help? And if the majority of Democrats in the House are successful in defeating NAFTA, do they have an alternative plan?
Well, I'm not sure that there is an opportunity for further structural change in NAFTA at this point. But I do think the debate needs to be joined more effectively on the pro-NAFTA side. There are suggestions, for example, by NAFTA opponents that insufficient funding exists for improving the environmental conditions on the border. But again, we have to ask the question, without NAFTA, will there be more? There are concerns about American plants moving to Mexico. They already have that capacity to do that. There are concerns about reducing American tariffs, but the Mexican tariffs are much higher. In a relative sense, Mexico will be giving more to the trade reduction than the United States has given. And we've seen the positive effects of increased trade in the last 6 years, when we've gone from a 6% or $6 billion trade deficit to a $5 billion trade surplus, and that can continue. In any case, I think we need to argue the case better and more effectively on the pro-NAFTA side, and we also need to engage the political situation better, because so far the opponents are doing a better job in approaching members of Congress and persuading them of their opposition.
Common statement.
Let me just answer the last part of the question. Will there be another plan? I think the defeat of NAFTA would make it extremely difficult to come back quickly. I'm not saying it would never happen, but I think it would be difficult to have a substitute proposal very quickly.
Common statement heard today is that the president's speech was very short on details on the health reform plan. What is your understanding of the cost and benefits of the health plan? Will it vary by region, gender, age, employment status, lifestyle, et cetera?
Well, the answer to the last is yes. Obviously, it does have different effects on different groups in the society. It's a long answer to give to that question. We're probably going to see the details in a matter of 3 or 4 weeks as the legislative language is written to support this proposal. Now, those of you who are, again, familiar with Washington know that when the legislative language is written, 1,000 at least, probably 5,000 or 10,000 or 100,000, very expert lawyers and analysts will start looking at the language, and we'll have a better understanding of support and opposition for it, and a better and more focused debate. But it will have costs, but the cost of doing nothing, the president made this point again and again, the cost of doing nothing is enormous. We spent as a society something like $74.5 billion on health care in 1970. That's not the government, that's the whole society. 10 years later, the cost was $260 billion, more than three times the number of a decade before. In 1990, 10 years later, the cost was $680 billion, again, almost three times the number of 260. And it is today estimated to be between $800 and $900 billion, headed surely, absolutely surely, for $1 trillion within a year or 15 months. Over the next 5 or 6 years, you might have costs of $5 trillion, more than the entire present national debt in health care expenditure. Now, these costs are rising at rates way beyond inflation, are headed beyond 14% of gross national product toward 20% of gross national product. When no other country in the world spends more than 10, that's Canada. And Canada is far more committed to health care and costs more in Canada than any place else in the industrial world. So we've got a serious problem of inaction. how it will affect young people, old people, it would take a long time to answer that question. Typically, young people are among those who do not choose to have insurance. And when they're employed in a system where they have to get it by themselves or it's not provided, make the judgment not to get it. That is part of the problem of universal care, because if there is illness or accident, those people are treated and their cost of health care is transferred to others in the system. It tends to hang together as a problem and needs to hang together as a solution. But over the coming months, there will be elaborate hearings. They'll last through the rest of this session of Congress. And next year, we hope to have an early consideration by the committees and a bill on the floor, as I say, in late spring or early summer. But all of this will be vetted fully. All the questions and complaints will be examined. They need to be examined. And then we need, as the President has said, to have a system of annual review or other means to test the reality of our projections and our estimates and our conclusions about what will happen. Because health care now dominates so much of our national economy, $14, $7 of our national economy is committed to it, and involves all of us in one way or the other, that it is difficult to make secure judgments about costs because we can't make secure judgments about the behavior of people. This program has been more vetted and more examined and more consulted about than any other public program in my experience in the Congress. And as has been said many times, Mrs. Clinton ran a task force that brought all the actuarial people in the federal government together for the first time, outside consultants and so on. But still, we're going to need to have a system of review after the program is put in place.
The administration has put together a plan to resolve the forestry crisis in the Northwest. Do you think the Clinton plan will solve the issue? And if not, what do you see as the solution?
Well, this is another complicated subject. The northern spotted owl protection issue has closed down the federal timber program on the western slopes of Washington, Oregon, and in Northern California. That and the protection of other species have led to court injunctions. The administration has put forth a program which may or may not be successful in getting that injunction fully lifted and some degree of timber harvesting restored. Having said that, I want to make it clear that both on the west side of the states of Oregon, Washington, and in Northern California, and on the east side forests of Washington and Oregon, I favor a sustainable system of protection of the ecosystem. I do not believe that we should return to the excessive levels of harvesting that existed in the 1980s. But at the same time, we also ought to recognize that the proposal of the administration is a drastic reduction in those levels, really taking them down by 80% in many cases. And we need to be conscious of the fact that that's going to be disruptive of communities, it's going to cost jobs, it's going to present some severe social problems. But eventually, I believe it's possible to have some reasonable level of appropriate timber harvesting in a system of management in which all the resources, watershed protection and wildlife and fish and old growth are protected. But this is just the first step. I have been critical of what I thought was some of the inadequacies of the administration's programs, but I have supported their recent efforts on the east side forests to develop a temporary screening system and to develop a more effective long-term policy to lead to a draft EIS, Environmental Impact Statement, next year. In a sort of a rare reversal of practice, a forest products company has taken this plan to court rather than environmental groups, which is more the typical situation of appealing to litigation. I hope we can work it out. It may be necessary, if we can't work it out, for the Congress to try to make some judgments which make the implementation of a reasonable program possible.
Before asking the final question, I'd like to present you with a certificate of appreciation from the National Press Club. A book called Eye on Washington, The Presidents Who Have Known Me by George Thames, retired New York Times photographer and winner of last year's Fourth Estate Award.
First good friend. Most famous single picture, I think, in American politics, at least as I know. John F. Kennedy looking out at the window of the Oval Office.
Final question is, after Taekwondo, what is next? Skydiving, marathoning, triathlon, Ironman competition, or rollerblading?
None of the above. I'm going to continue with Taekwondo. I got an enormous amount of good publicity breaking these boards. And if I can do that a few more times, maybe I can convince some of my colleagues that although I'm mild-mannered and easygoing, if I get too aroused, I'll simply come in and break the desk. But seriously, in dealing with the Congress, you always have to appeal to sweet reason and to intellectual persuasion. The press thinks we have far greater tools of pressure and influence than actually exist. I've told the story before, but I'll tell it again for those that maybe haven't heard it. When I first was elected to Congress, we had a briefing from John McCormick, and he told us that it was possible, he thought, for people to be elected by accident, but not reelected by accident. The message was subtle but clear. Come back in 2 years' time, and if you're still around, we'll take you more seriously. The second speech was, Democrats were getting these speeches, Republicans were getting similar ones, I'm sure, on the other side of the aisle. The second speech was given by Michael Kerwin, who was a powerful member of the Appropriations Committee from Ohio, in charge of all the public works appropriations in the country. He said he wanted to warn us against the single greatest danger that could occur to a new member of Congress beginning his or her career. And we said, what was that, to each other? And he leaned forward and said, that danger is thinking for yourselves. He said, don't do that, for heaven's sakes. He said, don't do that. Maybe if it's some little parochial matter in your own district, it's all right to think for yourself. Otherwise, he said, trust the subcommittee chairman. Trust the committee chairman. Trust the chairman of the Democratic caucus. Trust the majority leader. And especially, he said, especially pray God, trust the speaker. Trust the speaker. I remember being outraged. I had come, as I told you a few minutes ago, to be a reformer, to lead forward with my colleagues in meeting the problems of the 60s and 70s. And to hear a senior member of my party say I shouldn't even think for myself was outrageous. I was furious. In the 29 years since that time, it has been my honor to be a subcommittee chairman, a committee chairman, the chairman of the Democratic caucus, the Democratic whip, the majority leader, and now the speaker. The wise words of Mr. Kerwin come across that generation of time as a reminder of how right he was. But there is still a problem. Members of Congress insist on thinking for themselves. Democrats or Republicans, conservatives or liberals, they're thinking about some difficult problems that are facing this Congress and the country. I think they're doing so with great diligence and integrity. I'm satisfied that if the public could be in the halls of Congress, individual members of the public, day after day, hour after hour, they would come away with an enormously enhanced opinion of the work of the Congress and their individual members. I hope the record of this Congress will prove that to be true. Thank you very much.